too many of us operate with this karmic understanding that if I'm doing well, I'm going to get rewarded. Mm-hmm. And then we Christianize that by saying, God is happy with me when I have material blessings, when my health is good, when my kids are obedient. But too often when we do that, we actually miss the point of the good news. We miss the crucifixion. We miss the God hidden in suffering and death.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of White Horse Inn. I'm Eric Landry, and I'm filling in for Mike Horton as he recovers from his recent heart surgery. I'm joined in this series by Justin Holcomb and Bob Hiller. Together, we're talking about the good life. Guys, in our last episode, we defined the good life. We talked about the different gifts that God has given us. We went to Ecclesiastes, where he talks about good food and good drink and the love of your spouse and even the toil of your work, which, you know, we're used to seeing as part of the curse of the fall. But the preacher says that that's part of the good life that God has given to us. I think the challenge that a lot of our listeners are probably facing is that in addition to the pursuit of the good life, there's also suffering that they've got to deal with in this life. There are unpleasant activities, feelings, there are unfulfilled expectations, the kind of suffering that divorce brings, or a bad diagnosis, or kids that are in rebellion. How do we help people understand the pursuit of the good life, even when their life around them seems like it's in a bit of shambles? Has God forgotten them? Has he turned his face away from them and said, you know, you're on the other side of the good life because you're suffering? Or how is God at work even when there are challenges to the good life?
Well, sometimes, and this is not the main point of what we want to say, but sometimes it's the natural consequence of our foolishness.
Yeah.
So sometimes the suffering is suffering because of things I brought about by my own hand, by my own selfishness, and by violating God and my neighbor in thought, word, and deed. And then other times it's because of the suffering at other people's hands. And so I think coming to terms with the reality that the fallen world does not only mean, it primarily means that things are not right between me and God, and us and God. And I am in cosmic rebellion. But the other part of the fall is exactly Genesis 3, which is that the very good things God gave us to do now have toil, pain, frustration involved in them. There's going to be work in childbearing.
Right.
Now it will be with pain. Now it will be with frustration. And so I think that's a helpful place to start. It's not, we're not doing karma.
Right.
So that's one thing we're definitely not saying. Consequences because of decisions I've made and decisions other people have made is why they're suffering. Sometimes there's just suffering that is, you know, cells dividing. That's not anything I've done or someone else has done. It's just the cells have grown and multiplied into a tumor. Again, that is related to the fall. You can say that without saying God's getting his pound of flesh, or dharma, the cosmic scheme of the world, is at you because you're a horrible person and you deserve it. So we're not saying karma. That's important to start out with.
Yeah, I think it's worth thinking about the impact of sin on the creation. As you mentioned, sin goes off like an atomic bomb and it wrecks everything around it. So whether that's my own sinful nature that leads me to commit all kinds of sins that have natural consequences, or whether it's the burden on the creation, right? And so you'll have hurricanes and earthquakes and natural disasters that come along that are not necessarily, as you mentioned, the result of karma, or as some of our preachers would have us believe, because there were more sinners in this part of the country than another part of the country. This is just why suffering comes about. And so it's interesting to think about this. Does it mean God is against us, that he's no longer provident, that he's left? I mean, this really gets into some very deep and difficult questions about the goodness of God and the theodicy. If there is a good God, why is there suffering? And oftentimes, those questions are very difficult and very burdensome, but also inaccessible. We just can't know the why all the time. And sometimes that conversation is distracting from actually dealing with the problems at hand.
That's a great point.
I think a helpful way to think about this big picture, a little bit abstractly, but this is a topic I give to a lot of my students and in churches, because I think for me it's been so helpful, is talking about the difference between duality and dualism. And I use the language of duality as a summary of how the Bible talks about how the world and we are. And what I mean, think of a circle with a dotted line down the middle. There's two dimensions that are related to each other, and they belong together. On a board, I'll draw a circle with a dotted line, and so I'll put material and immaterial parts of the body, body and soul. Creation, you know, I'm going to hit the table. You know, there's creation, and then there's a dimension of creation that is immaterial, eternal, like the laws of logic in ethics. Like there's a realm, there's a non-natural realm, a supernatural realm. So that's duality. They belong together. I argue this from looking at Revelation 6, disembodied souls crying out, "How long, O Lord? Like, give us our bodies back." In all eternity, Jesus, well, first Jesus, he has a resurrected body, and we're going to be resurrected like him. We're going to have bodies, which is shocking to many Christians, that we're going to have bodies forever, resurrected bodies. That's the biblical picture. They're a distinction, but they belong together, and they influence each other. Well, what happens is a dualism is you end up drawing that dotted line really firm. The first step is you take two things. It's a distortion of the duality, and you make a too firm a distinction between body and soul. We'll use body and soul as the example. And then you separate those two, and then you oppose them. So make a firm distinction, and then you separate. There's a body over here, the soul over here. They're not really related to each other. And then you oppose them in conflict, and eventually that conflict results in a hierarchy where the spirit is more important than the body. And when you do that, you have what's called Gnosticism. It's a dualism of Gnosticism, and Plato can devolve into this type of dualism where the soul is so important and you got to get rid of the body because the body's the shackle of the soul, and you go from there. And so Gnosticism is a heightening of the spiritual realm over the material realm, the secret knowledge over, you know, normal wisdom and knowledge. But there's another way that dualism plays itself out, which is just flipping that hierarchy, privileging the body over the soul, which is hedonism, which is, who cares about the soul and the immaterial if it's even there? Let's have fun. What would be pleasurable? How about some wealth? How about some drink? How about some food? How about some vacation life? Like all of the lists that we gave earlier from Ecclesiastes, of living wisely, work, wealth, food, drink, sex, pleasure. Yeah, let's do hedonism. So what's happened is, I think part of the pain is that many of us are living in dualistic worlds where we have to pit things that we don't have to pit against each other. That's why some people feel guilty for sitting on the back porch and having a drink with their friends, for going home to spend time with their spouse and their kids, for doing recreation. I mean, if we're embodied creatures and we start feeling guilty for those types of things, maybe we're doing some type of privileging of the spiritual over the material. And so we have that happening in many Christian conversations. We have kind of a Gnostic dualism taking place. But for the most part, the patterns of this world look like hedonistic. They devalue the spiritual. So it looks like we might have a competition of dualisms happening.
Interesting.
And we don't have to live in that world. So what we did in the previous episode was actually exploring putting those things back together. And that's why I think it could be so life-giving. So if that's the case, something like work is either devalued or overvalued. Something like sex is devalued or overvalued. I mean, a lot of the Christian conversation about the body or sex is, well, I guess it's good for procreation. Do it as necessary, I guess. And then you have a pornified culture of right now. So I think that's an example. I'll stop there, but I think those could be guardrails for kind of giving some input to what is this pain that we're feeling? Is it because we're living in these illusory worlds that we're not supposed to live in?
Do you think, though, that even as Christians, we fall into this way of thinking so that if I'm suffering in my body, then something is wrong with me?
Yeah.
God is upset with me.
Or we think, and I think we fall very quickly into the Gnostic tendency here to say something's wrong with the body itself or the creation itself, or God wants to set me free from my body to feel better. So I have a quick story that hopefully will be very quick. When I was on my internship, we call it a vicarage in the Lutheran church, I did a Bible study at a retirement home, and I decided to do my Bible study on the resurrection of the body. One of the women there, her husband had recently died, and I thought this would be a Bible study to bring her a great deal of comfort. So we all gathered there in the Bible study room. It was me and all the ladies at the retirement home, and they're all walking in on their walkers, boasting about and arguing over who has more pain at night when they get out of bed in the morning, who's suffering and hurting more, and everyone's complaining about everything. And I start the Bible study off by saying, "Ladies, I have wonderful news for you. This is good news. When Christ returns, you get these bodies back." And one of the ladies there whose husband had recently died, she says, "Vicar, that is the worst news I've ever heard in my entire life." And I think there's a sense in which we encounter suffering and pain, and we think what we need to do is escape.
Hmm.
And so an escape is necessary. And since the body has been the burden for me for so long, what I need is a spiritual existence. And so we almost pursue a dualism where we cut ourselves off from created stuff. We cut ourselves off from the goodness of creation and sort of only cling to the suffering or the consequences of the fall, not recognizing that what salvation is not an escape from the good creation. It's the resurrection. It's all things being made new. And when you start to recognize that salvation is all things being made new, you start to look at your body in a different way. You start to recognize that your body is something not to be dismissed, but to be renewed, that will suffer as a result of sin, but also will be raised to a new life. And so it's going to impact the way you treat your body now, the way you live now, recognizing that things will be good in the future.
Yeah. And I think one of the consequences of doing this dualism, think about how do people solve the very question about the suffering that we have? How do people solve that? And many modern people address problems with the idea that some type of technique is going to be the solution. If I just had the right technique, the right tools, the right information, that'll fix the problems in my life. And so one way that the patterns of the world is, what technique do I have? And we have spiritual versions of that. That's what you're hitting on is the default human heart is karmic. I mean, not even religious, just anyone is. We default to that. I still remember years ago, our house flooded. I was doing some travels with Mike. We were going to Africa, and it was, you know, Theo Global. We were doing these things and doing lectures in Africa and India and all these amazing trips, and got news that our house had flooded, and it had been flooding for a week.
Oh.
It soaked up the plaster walls until they started sliding off the walls, and the floorboards popped. And the neighbor, after a week of the main water supply in the master bathroom, was just broke. Water was going out the front door. That's how we found out.
Gosh.
So I got woken up. Someone called my wife, told her it's like 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm in England. I just went to the Eagle and Child where C.S. Lewis hung out. I had Guinness in my belly. My wife and children I'm at Keble College. I'm right there. I get woken up, and my wife says this happened. Anyway, a lot longer version of it. But then what happens? The very first thing, I woke up and she told me, she said, "The house is flooded." And I said, "I want to cry." And then the very next thought in my head was, "It's because you drop below 10% in your tithing." Literally.
Really?
Like, and I'm a gospel guy. Like, everyone thinks, like, I talk about the gospel so much. They're like, "Do you believe in any aspect?" Like, they, you know, if you do the gospel thing really well, everyone thinks you're an antinomian. So here I am, you know, Captain preach the gospel every time. And to myself, I have a voice of condemnation that says, "It's because you're not giving enough."
Yep.
So I just want everyone to be clear. We all have that voice in our head.
Yeah.
Like, we think when something happens with our kids, it's because, well, I'm rebellious, and so God's letting me know what it's like. But we end up thinking we need a technique. And so we can go over some that the world offers. That's probably really good advice. But this is how spiritual disciplines get distorted. Mm-hmm. We go, oh, I need my technique. I need solitude. I need fastings. Solitude's great. Fasting's wonderful. Reading your Bible is spectacular. But we find ways of making these things. What can I do to solve my problem? Which might not be the first question we need to do. What is God's disposition toward us in these situations? So let me give you some, because I referred to the cult of busy previous episode. And it's, again, Harvard Business Review, The Epidemic of Busyness. In the very last part, the ahas, and again, these are great advice. Keep a time diary. Probably a good idea to see where you're squandering it and all that. Was, you know, sure. Prioritize what matters. And feel free to jump in on anything you want to. I'm going to give you the list.
I was just thinking about how my time diary always gets in the way of my time on Facebook. So that's not as useful as I want.
Yeah, don't put those together.
No.
Prioritize what matters is number two. Do one small thing. Abandon perfectionism.
I did one small thing. I started a time diary.
Subtract, don't add. Model it from the top and take that vacation. Hey, all of those. It's like taking your vitamins and working out and eating a salad every once in a while and drinking a lot of water. That is probably spectacular advice. But thankfully, we have more than just this wonderful advice. I love Tim Keller's, you know, pairing. It's not just good advice. We're offering people good news.
Right.
And what happens when we end up giving spiritual techniques to the fix as opposed to the good news in the middle of all of this? And I think that's what, as simplistic as it sounds, Eric, your question is, what do we say to people is, we got one main thing that we want to say,
right?
is that the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ is what draws our attention to what our souls need, but a healthy way of engaging all of this.
I recently introduced my congregation, Bob, to Luther's distinction between the theology of the cross and the theology of glory, particularly as it applies to suffering. Mm-hmm. And the idea, kind of what Justin said earlier, that too many of us operate with this karmic understanding that if I'm doing well, I'm going to get rewarded. Mm-hmm. And then we Christianize that by saying, God is happy with me when I have material blessings, when my health is good, when my kids are obedient. But too often when we do that, we actually miss the point of the good news. We miss the crucifixion. We miss the God hidden in suffering and death. How do you think that the theology of the cross helps us understand, you know, suffering in the midst of God's work, even in our lives right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's interesting. I just preached a sermon recently on the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Plain in Luke's gospel. And there in Luke chapter 6, you kind of get going this way. Theology of glory says something like this. Blessed are those who have figured it out. Blessed are those who have all the right techniques and follow all the right rules. Blessed are those whose time journal is accurate and they have figured out how to do a time journal without adding something and only subtracting something, which just doesn't work. Blessed are those who have found financial peace and all of those, you know, all of these sorts of things. And then you come to the Lord and he says, blessed are you who are poor. And you say, Jesus, you don't understand the word blessed. Poor are not blessed, they're poor. And Jesus says, no, because theirs is the kingdom of God. And blessed are you who are hungry now, for you shall be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. And blessed are you when people hate you and when they exclude you and revile you and spurn your name as evil on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven, for so their fathers did to the prophets. This is the theology of the cross, which is, you got to be very careful when we talk about theology of the cross. We're not talking about theories of atonement. We're not talking about that sort of thing, but rather what we're saying is the theology of the cross is, how do we think about God? Where do we start our thinking about God? And then how does that help us understand the world around us and my experience of it? So where do we start our talk about God? Do we start about talking about God with his divine attributes, his holiness? Do we start talking about God in terms of his omniscience, omnipresence, what God can and cannot do? Or do we start our conversation about God in the womb of Mary, in the manger, on a cross, walking out of a tomb? We actually think it's the latter, that if you want to talk about God faithfully and properly, you look to Christ. Now, Why does that matter for this conversation? Because that means if we're not going to find God merely in the glorious stuff, but we're going to find him in the muck and the mire of the world, when my life is in the muck and the mire, God is right there.
That's right.
And I want to say with me, which is fine, but he's right there for me. And actually, he turns my suffering and my pain into something that actually drives me closer to him. So Luther says what makes a great theologian is, it's always fun to use Latin on the show, oratio, tentatio, and meditatio. Oratio, prayer, meditatio, meditation on the word, and tentatio, agonizing suffering. And what Luther says is the more you grow in your faith, the deeper you are going to be studying the word. That's going to cause you to grow, and then the devil's going to attack you for this. And when the devil attacks you, it's going to drive you to prayer. This is the beauty, Luther says. Or maybe it's John Kleinig in his wonderful book, Grace Upon Grace. The devil's work is always counterproductive because the more he attacks the Christian, the more the Christian flees to Christ. And so you find yourself wrestling with the word, struggling with the word, agonizing because of suffering, suffering because of temptation, suffering because of bad decisions you've made, suffering because the world doesn't make sense, suffering because you're Job and you don't know why you're suffering. But all of these things then serve to drive us back to the crucified one who is risen for us and has promised to never leave nor forsake us. And so the theology of the cross helps us conceptualize of our suffering as a place where God not only doesn't abandon us, but actually is working on us and for us and with us to help us grow in our faith and love and trust of him.
It reminds me of the article that Tim Keller wrote in the Atlantic Monthly after his cancer diagnosis was so dire. Toward the end of the article, he says, "To our surprise and encouragement, Kathy," that's his wife, "Kathy and I have discovered that the less we attempt to make this world into a heaven, the more we are able to enjoy it. No longer are we burdening it with demands impossible for it to fulfill. We have found that the simplest things, from sun on the water, flowers in the vase, to our own embraces, bring more joy than ever. This has taken us by surprise. As God's reality dawns more on my heart, slowly and painfully, and through many tears, the simplest pleasures of this world have become sources of daily happiness. It is only as I have become, for lack of a better term, more heavenly minded, that I can see the material world for the astonishingly good divine gift that it is." It was his suffering and turning to Christ in prayer and meditating on the Psalms and remembering again God's control and promises and his goodness toward him in Christ that allows him to look through that suffering and still see God's goodness in the world.
I think that's why when you brought up providence in the previous episode, it was so helpful. There, for a light bulb went off, like something that is a foundational doctrinal point about how God relates to his creation. Because God is so sovereign and creative that he can bend evil and suffering into blessing. Yes, he's sovereign, of course, but what's he doing with his sovereignty? Is he's still creative.
Right.
And that's what Joseph was saying in Genesis 50:20. We all have moments in our life. I'll go back to this just personally. I wanted a job in my hometown in Sarasota. My mom and dad live there, my sister and her husband, and it's this wonderful school right on the water. I could go fishing in between classes. I was clearly the front runner for this gig. And then the person got my dream job. Nailed it, got it, somehow beat me. It was between him and me. And I knew this guy who got the job because he was the bartender in Charlottesville where I was a professor. So I'm not throwing rocks at him, but he was the bartender in the college town where I was a professor in the college town. But he got the job and I was devastated. This was the plan for my life. Like, it was so close to getting what I wanted. And my mom, my dad, everyone, we were done for. And then my mom said something. She's like, "Well, I'm so curious what God has in store for you since you didn't get this." And I thought, "God, stop talking like a mom. That's so stupid." Like, I didn't say that to her, but inside I was like, "Stop spiritualizing this. Let me just be angry." Yeah. And then the next month I met my wife and I have these kids. And I'm like, if I would have gotten what I wanted, what would I not have now? Now, again, my suffering, that was the first world suffering. I didn't get my dream job on the water with my family. But that was helpful for me to view other moments of suffering, emotional or physical, spiritual, psychological, to go, okay, what might God be doing? So the opposite of technique is miracle or right. You know, providence. A miracle and providence theologically for us, there's not a huge separation between right. what a miracle is and what providence is. It's just God's activity, and is he doing it directly or indirectly? So I like saying, you know, providence or miracle versus technique, because that puts it on us as creatures looking to God going, what might you be doing? Going back to your point, like Satan's suffering of God's people draws us to him. Mm. That's what came to mind, was the creativity and sovereignty might be useful.
I think that Joseph comment you made is very helpful as well. And it's also worth remembering this. What we're not saying is that therefore evil is actually good.
Right.
That's not what we're getting at here. Not that Mm-mm. that guy getting the job was evil, but God has different yeah. plans or something like this. But something like Tim Keller's situation,
yeah.
Wherein he's suffering from cancer.
Right.
And there's a sense in which I don't think we want to say cancer is evil, but we certainly don't want to say it's good. And we don't want to celebrate cancer, but we can see how God uses cancer to direct things. God can use this evil for a good. Now, this is going to get into bigger issues such as injustice and suffering throughout the world and starvation and things like this. And why is God allowing these things? And I think sometimes we have to allow ourselves to say, I don't know. I just don't know. But that's why my hope is not necessarily these problems all being solved for me in some satisfying way, but rather death and resurrection is the hope, that these things ultimately are going to be put down and to death, that evil will be removed, and that we will rise again to be made right. God is justifying, restoring all things to rights. But that's where the theology of the cross becomes so helpful, because the theology of the cross takes our eyes off of the suffering and the hidden God and what he's up to up in heaven, knocking all these things out. And rather, it focuses us in on the one who takes sin to the grave on a cross and rises again, leaving it behind, never to draw it back. Our hope is in this Christ who enters our suffering, who goes into the valley of the shadow of death, and then finds the way out for us.
Going back to your comment about cancer, I mean, we want cell division, because it's good yeah. for us to grow. Right. Like, God providentially made bodies to grow, and cells divide and they multiply, except for when they grow distorted and too much and too fast. That's when it does become, it is an evil that kills. And something else, just to be really clear, death is not the way it's supposed to be.
Yes.
Jesus
yes.
was angry at death. So we're not spiritualizing death by any stretch, but going back to the Keller quote, that's what his whole point was. Well, it does remind me that I'm a creature. And it does remind me of the gifts of receiving. So it throws him back on his creatureliness. And it makes me think of the creator-creation distinction. If we violate that creator-creation distinction, we're in la-la land, where we're living in an illusory world. And part of the gift of facing our mortality is reminding us it's God's world and we're living in it. And I used to teach a class years ago, undergrad class, called Death and Dying. Watching a bunch of 19 and 18-year-olds take a class on death and dying, the number one question I would get from them, hey, can we talk about like life and the good life? Like, yeah, my family's successful and I'll probably be successful, but I'm not sure if this is all it's all cracked up to be, because they were confronting death. These were some Christians, but most of them were not professing Christians that I knew of. I didn't ask every student. We had the good life question and trying to figure out these questions that we're asking here. So again, I don't want to spiritualize it. It's
no.
evil. Satan wants God's images dead and destroyed. So Jesus was angry at it.
That's right. It's the enemy. But this is where the psalmist would encourage us, teach us to number our days, right? Help us to have a sober view of the reality that unless Christ comes again, you're going to die. Have a wonderful day, White Horse listeners. Like, this is the reality of it. And so we need to number our days so that we can view our lives properly and put them in the proper perspective. That perspective enables us then as to pursue a life that loves and serves the neighbor and isn't merely self-serving and that sort of thing, because we recognize our time here is short and our responsibilities are real.
That's why we're going to Ecclesiastes.
Yes.
I mean, we're asking good life questions and we're reading Ecclesiastes? Like, seriously? Right. Have we read Ecclesiastes? I mean, I wrote a Bible study on that thing, and I was on the plane working on a Bible study, reading through Ecclesiastes. I actually put some songs in my earbuds, and it was actually Johnny Cash singing Nine Inch Nails Hurt on repeat while I was reading Ecclesiastes. And by the second time around, I was sobbing. Yeah. Ecclesiastes will drive you to tears. The guy next to me looked at me and said, "Hey, man, are you okay? So what are you doing?
Johnny Cash, man."
I said, "I'm reading Ecclesiastes." He said, "I know, I've been watching you. Are you okay? Do I need to talk to you about Jesus?" I said, "No, man, I'm a pastor. I'm good. I had to work on a Bible study on this thing." And he was like, "Ecclesiastes is messing you up." And I was like, "Yeah, but this is really good kind." So we're highlighting Ecclesiastes because there's actually freedom in saying all is vanity.
Yep.
Ecclesiastes is saying the emperor has no clothes. The only way of the good life is not the way that you think it is and the world's told you that it is. Think of an illustration on this. I mean, we're all dads, and I played a little bit of sports, but we've all seen this, and maybe we've done it to our children. But imagine a little child who has to carry the weight of the father's expectations of his own performance in sports in his youth. And we've seen that, like, that kid cannot carry the weight of your disappointment in yourself.
Yep.
And there's a cruelty to that, right? Mm. Now imagine how we engage other dimensions of our life. Food cannot carry the weight of my spiritual, emotional, whatever disappointments or sadness. Sex can't carry the weight. The cruelty of what parents can do to children, of expecting them to carry that weight. There's a picture of how we look at these gifts, honor, wisdom, work, relationship, food, drink, can't carry the weight of what God has called us to fix our eyes on Him. It can't fulfill that. And I'm not doing the idolatry talk. I'm saying, why are we looking at those tools to do this? And then we end up distorting them and misusing them and causing harm left and right.
Yeah. Part of the reason, though, that we look to those things and think that we're going to find the good life in them is there's something that is part of our creation that says there is something better than what we're experiencing right now.
Right.
And so then we look at the things that bring us pleasure and enjoyment. We look at the smiles on our kids' faces and we go, there must be something behind that that gets me to the thing that I know is out there. And it's maybe an echo of Eden that sounds down through history that tells me there's something else bigger and better than what I'm experiencing right now. We've talked a little bit about Alan Noble's book, You Are Not Your Own. In one section, he says, we ought to expect that life will remain difficult, inordinately and senselessly difficult. In a rightly ordered and just society, the desire to self-medicate, which is so ubiquitous in our own time, would be dramatically reduced. But we don't live in a rightly ordered and just society, and we should not expect that fact to change anytime soon. That kind of realism, I think, is very helpful for us to be counseling other Christians, to even look at our neighbors and say, you know, you were made for something more than what you're experiencing today.
The light bulb just went off because I'm talking about dualism and dualism. And so think about this. Perhaps the hedonistic one leads to a pessimism of darkness, and the spiritual Gnostic feels so positive and optimistic, and everything can be fixed if we just do enough spiritual stuff. So we have these two extremes of this, like, hedonistic pessimism that we would look at and say, that's pessimistic. Look at the spiritual life, and that would be good. What you're describing is realism.
Right.
That is not going to either one of those illusions. That's the gift of being the creature in the life of how it is. Going back to the suffering and the realism, there was a young woman who she actually wrote her story of abuse in the very first book my wife and I did called Rid of My Disgrace. And she was a victim of group assault. And I was with her. And one, I prayed with her as she prayed for her assailants that they would come to Christ so she could worship with them in heaven, which that's a miracle. Then I said, hey, I'm like, I'd love to hear your thoughts on you and God and what God has done. And has he been faithful? Have you seen him being faithful? And she said, I think what happened to me was horribly evil. And I wish it didn't happen, but I couldn't imagine what God has done on the other side of it in the fruit and disposition and kindness and love of God on the other side of it. It was going back to that thing that you brought up, Bob, about Luther and evil and drawing us to Christ. She didn't have to distort it. She didn't have to deny it.
Yep.
And she also didn't have to distort it into a good. She said, it's evil, but God is so creative, and I said, and sovereign, apparently, that he can bend something that is evil into something you could not have imagined. I think that's the key of the biblical picture of the world, is we don't have to go around theologically editing everything that happens, because realism allows us to actually go back to being creatures.
And I walk a very close line of being a pessimist, but realism comes with a healthy view of the fact that there is sin in the world. We should not be surprised. We should be shocked by what we see. It's because it's awful. It is shocking. It's not right. It's not the way it's supposed to be. But it's not surprising when people do wicked and evil things, because the heart is wicked above all else, as the Lord says. So there's something about that that psychologically I think is beneficial to say that you're able to look at evil and say, that is evil. That is wrong. That's not the way God designed this to work. There must be something else for me to be able to recognize that what happened to her was demonic. For me to be able to look at someone who is suffering and say, that's not okay. Where does that inclination come from? The Lord has, what is, oh boy, I'm going to start to sound like a Calvinist, but not Calvinist, but Augustine, that there's that God-shaped hole inside of our heart, which is a weird thing and kind of strange to talk about. There is something there that says, obviously this is wrong. You see this and you say, I can now name that as evil, but what does the other side look like? And that's where God begins to do his making alive work after the killing has taken place.
Let's talk a little bit about recognizing that something is wrong, calling evil for what it is. What responsibility then does that put on us? If we are called to work for our neighbor's good, and maybe that's part of our responsibility even to pursue the good life, that it's not purely selfish, it's also for our neighbor's good. And we recognize that something is evil and wrong, that the world is disordered. What responsibility do we have beyond just kind of throwing up our hands in the air saying, well, that's the way the world is, and we just got to wait for Jesus to come back? How do we engage the world that is for our neighbor's good?
If we believe that God has made me and all creatures, and he's given me my eyes and my nose and my mouth and my tongue and all of my members and all of my family members and all these good gifts, and it's therefore my duty to thank and praise and serve and obey him. If we believe that this is true, that life is a gift, when we see injustice and evil, what we're witnessing is somebody trying to get in the way of the giver, someone to try and get in the way of the gifts. So our responsibility then is to remove the obstacle to the gift. So when we see suffering and injustice in this world, because you have a wicked government that withholds the ability for its people to eat properly. Hmm. It makes them unable to dig wells to get the water they need. Our responsibility now becomes to make sure they can get water, to be a conduit of the gift, to not allow the evil to prevent the good from coming. In a certain sense, I tell my congregation this, that's part of my job as a preacher, is my job is to give you the forgiveness of your sins, to help you hear the good news of what Christ has done for you. But your whole week is filled with things blocking you from receiving that gift. So my job as a preacher is to remove those obstacles so you can finally hear the good news. And it's the same with the created gifts. We all in our vocations have a responsibility to remove anything that would prevent our neighbor from receiving the gifts that God has for them.
I'm really sorry to do this, Bob, but I'm going to read from Calvin.
I forgive you?
So, the original Calvinist on Commentary on Isaiah writes this: uprightness and righteousness are divided into two parts. First, that we should injure nobody. And secondly, that we should bestow our wealth in abundance on the poor and needy. And these two ought to be joined together, for it is not enough to abstain from acts of injustice if thou refuse thy assistance to the needy, nor will it be of much avail to render thine aid to the needy if at the same time you rob some of those that you've bestowed to them. These two parts, therefore, must be held together, provided only that we have our love of our neighbor approved and accepted by God.
Well, this is, think about, what sort of God do you serve? You serve a God who gives everything. He is the God who is a self-giving God who comes to forgive all of your sins, to remove your burdens, to remove your evil. You have the God who says, cast your cares upon me, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. You have Jesus who goes to towns to get rest because he's just exhausted. And people show up overwhelmed and he's like, well, I'm going to keep loving. I'm going to keep serving. Like, you have a God who has looked at you with all of your burdens, all of your sorrows, all of your shames, and has removed them and promised you everlasting life. That now shapes you for how you view your neighbor. That is another person for whom Christ has done this, and he's going to use you as his instrument to heal.
And what did Jesus do when he had hungry people? He made too much food. That's one of my favorite things. He didn't just make enough. He made too much. I mean, Jesus was extravagant that each disciple had to get a basket and go pick up the leftovers of making too much food. Like that, when you start talking about what kind of God do we serve, that's it. Yep. Extravagant. Yep. As Mike loves to talk about, the fatherly liberality of the disposition of God. So Kelly Capick wrote a book called For God So Loved He Gave, or something like that. I mean, and this all about the theology of the gift, and that if we've been talking about the gift, and if we're the recipients, there's a way of talking about how we'll respond. It's not moralism. Mm-hmm. We're the recipients of grace and gift and unconditional love. We now know what gift, grace, and love look like because we've received them. So now we're some of the best people to give it to other people because we're like, oh, I know how powerful this is. Mm-hmm. Oh, gift, grace, and love to other people, service, need, what Calvin said. So I love your point.
Even in the midst of our suffering and their suffering, even when we don't see all of the promises of God coming true in our own lifetime, but we can go as embassies of God's promises to other people who are also suffering and say, here are the gifts that I've been given. Here are the gifts that you've been given. Look through the gift and see the gift giver.
When I'm training pastors or lay leaders to deal with suffering, specifically abuse, there is research on interviewing survivors of abuse, and they said, hey, what have people done that's really helpful? And most people assume, okay, really good advice, really good psychological insights, some type of healing techniques. And the number one on the top of the list in every list of every survey of every survivor is being listened to and believed. And to be able to tell people, what do people actually need to be listened to and believed? And so going back to your point, there's something to the simplicity of that type of love for others. Many people think when they're staring at the world of suffering themselves or others that they need to do something magical and huge. We have no idea the gift that our listening in prayers and literally being there. That's why in the Jewish tradition, sitting Shiva at death, you sit there without words to be present.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org. You can also give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. 7556. We'll see you next time at the White Horse Inn.